Mr. Powers, are you ready to begin redirect?
Yes, I am, Special Master.
Thank you. Dr. Munford, you may have the role.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Dr. Munford.
Good afternoon.
I see you're getting situated there. Are you all set?
I think so.
Okay. Well, you recall yesterday afternoon there were a series of questions that Respondent's Counsel asked you. Do you remember that starting that cross-examination yesterday?
Yes.
You recall a line of questions about some of the research that you were conducting. Do you remember those questions?
Yes.
And questions about hyperbaric therapy and lab reliability testing.
Right.
Why is it that you were conducting those tests in the first place, or conducting that research in the first place?
Our perception is that some of the research efforts that have been going on in the field of autism have not been directed as much as we would like toward potential treatments and therapies and assessment methods that would actually lead fairly soon to taking better care of these children. Classically, the resources have been directed to a lot of work in classic genetics, and we wanted to look at the treatment strategies that we had developed with our collective clinical wisdom and make sure that they were safe, ultimately evaluate efficacy in a more rigorous fashion, and to refine our use of laboratory assessments. It came to our attention that a number of parents were renting hyperbaric chambers, and we wanted to make sure that they were not posing a risk to the children, so we wanted to look at the methylation biochemistry and the oxidative stress markers. So the initial study that was just a pilot study was intended not to be so much a rigorous assessment of efficacy as it was the first step, which would be to prove safety. So that's why we chose to look at the methylation biochemistries. And since we were doing the study, we also looked at therapeutic response, but the primary issue there was safety. With our lab split sample study, our primary concern is that we are in a situation where we have found value in using so-called functional laboratory assessments. Many traditional laboratory assessments are targeted more toward the detection of disease as opposed to the detection of suboptimal function in the period of time leading to frank expression of disease. So we wanted, as best we knew, as best we could, to know that those functional assessments we were utilizing are replicable, or to sort out which laboratories would not have reliability on split sample testing. So ARI ended up budgeting over $30,000 of a pretty meager budget to essentially do the lab split sample study. And that will ultimately become known. It's certainly possible that some of the labs we have relied on are stronger in some areas than others. And that's why we need to sort those issues out.
And excuse me, Dr. Munford, would it be your intent then with the hyperbaric study and the lab reliability study, if there are findings that you find significant, would you then be integrating those into the Defeat Autism Now recommendations and protocols?
Yes. We shared some preliminary data on split samples for allergy testing at the think tank that we held in April. And our plan is to also review at the think tank the split sample reliability for the other types of tests that we anticipate having statistically analyzed by then.
So these safety and efficacy studies aren't for your sort of proprietary use, but they're actually designed to be pushed out into the treatment community. Is that correct?
Oh, exactly. That's entirely the purpose, yes.
Okay. Are there any other research projects you're doing with that same general goal, that is looking at the safety and the efficacy of various treatments that you employ?
Well, I've actually just hired a clinical research director. Since I am primarily a clinician and a medical educator, I want to continue to participate in clinical research studies, but I wanted to have someone who could help me design them and carry out the protocols. So I hired someone that has had training in that arena so that when we do clinical trials and research at the Remlin Center, that will not be on limited by my relative lack of expertise, but we can actually continue to do higher quality and more complicated studies. One of the things that I'm very eager to do is what's called single subject, multiple baseline studies. And the reason that I'm so interested in this is that our anecdotal impression is that what we can do to recover Johnny might be totally different from what we can do to recover Susie. And so we need to figure out what is working for specific kids and what is it about those kids that makes that strategy of treatment more effective. So when you group a bunch of kids together and do the classic placebo-controlled double-blind study, that works great for evaluating a drug in patients that have the same symptom. It doesn't work as well for a situation in which you've got complex multi-system involvement. And so a way of doing that is to adapt some research from the behavioral world where they look at a single subject and document behaviors over time and then do interventions and look at the change in the subject. Ted Carr is one of the people who has published a fair amount using this type of research protocol, and he's actually contacted me. We have a phone conference call next week because he would like to do some of that type of research in our clinic, utilizing not just behavioral measures, but also wedding it to biomarkers biomedically. So I hope that my colleagues at ARI and I can lead the way in looking at well-respected research models that we can apply to individuals, as opposed to always thinking about research having to be done in broader groups. So another thing that we plan to do, I mentioned that we've met with the American Academy of Pediatrics. My job that I'm a little behind on due to this trial was to provide the AAP with our sort of wish list for research projects. We want to go after what we think of as the low-hanging fruit, the studies that we can do that can be completed relatively quickly so that the results can be utilized to help children. So we are going to try to encourage research on treatment protocols and especially on identifying biomarkers that help us subtype each of these types of autism, because our perspective is that the evolving model that we have regards a combination of genetic and environmental components, and perhaps lots of autisms with an S. This is language that's actually been adopted by the MIND Institute, and what it implies is that there may be a number of different ways that children are affected in ways that they ultimately exhibit autistic type behaviors. So there may be a number of pathways that are affected to give us this constellation of behavioral symptoms.
And Dr. Mumper, is it typical or atypical that a general practice pediatrician in a small town like Lynchburg would bother to hire a clinical research director?
I think that would be very atypical because it's a severely financially unwise thing to do.
Well, if it's a financially unwise thing to do, then why are you doing it?
Because I think it's the right thing to do. I've thought about that question a lot, and I think one thing that influenced me on this is that when I was a child, my house had a community swimming pool just behind our backyard, and at that time, which was in the 60s, they would not allow people of color to come and swim in the swimming pool. So my father and my family took the stand that we would then not participate. And so for all the summers of my childhood, I would play in the backyard, hearing the splashing from the swimming pool. And it, in a way that was reinforcing over and over and over, told me that my parents thought it was important that I stood up for what I thought was right. So there have been significant personal and professional disadvantages to speaking up in such a lone voice when there are clearly so many agencies that don't have the same concerns as I do. But I do think it's important to do what you think is right, even if there's some sacrifices involved.
What do you do to keep up with the science? I mean, do you follow the literature? How do you keep engaged with the science that's happening out
there?
Okay, because you were asked about some of this, about what articles you read and what articles you rely on and how you form your opinions. Can you describe to the special masters what you do to keep a pace of that?
It's quite a challenge because I think I mentioned I typically go to my office at 7:30 and leave about 6, and most of that time is devoted to clinical practice. But in my job at ARI, one of my roles is to decide what literature we teach to the clinicians that we're teaching in the clinician seminar. So in order to make that distinction, I feel that it's necessary to try to keep up with the literature. So I have a couple of listservs that send me articles based about autism or related subjects, and I certainly can't read all of those articles, but I try to read as many as I possibly can. Another impetus I have is that I'm the director for the clinical part of the think tank for the Autism Research Institute, so the scientists and clinicians have to submit their abstracts to me, and I'm the one that makes the judgment about what science they can present and what doesn't meet, our expectations for presentation. So that helps me keep abreast of the science. The other thing is that I get invited to speak in this country and overseas about these topics, and I like to be able to answer the questions when they're asked. And so I try to have a good grasp of the scientific literature in addition to my clinical experience so that I can field those questions from the audience.
Now, in this sort of monitoring and ongoing review of the literature, is it your experience that in the field of autism there is significant new science that comes out in an evolving way?
I have seen it explode exponentially, and I think that can be actually objectively validated by looking at the number of autism articles, and there's a big curve up over the last decade or so. The thing I also really like is that since I am the medical director for ARI, I frequently will get pre-publication confidential drafts of upcoming science with requests from the authors to make suggestions. I mean, obviously from my perspective as a clinician, on the way that they've written the papers or any aspects of the paper that I would critique or make suggestions on.
Now, I want to focus a little bit on some of the questions that you were asked about the content of your reports. And again, focusing first on yesterday afternoon, Do you recall questions about the article that was published in Medical Hypotheses?
Yes, I do.
And do you recall questions that suggested you were relying on that article to bolster an opinion that mercury as contained in vaccines was neurotoxic, or that it was somehow being cited in support of your ultimate opinion in causation? Do you remember that line of questions?
Yeah, and I actually don't think I appreciated at the time perhaps the intent of the question. I was thinking that the intent of the question was to point out that it wasn't in a refereed peer-reviewed journal and that it had been submitted by people who were not scientists. But the way that I cited the article, and I think that I tried to make it very clear in my report, was that it was to point to it as an example of mercury having myriad toxicities, and that it raised the issue of biochemical individuality in the patients because it specifically talks about things like route of excretion and individual variability and those types of issues. So I certainly did not ever, in any aspect of my testimony here before this court, mean to imply that I was equating autism with direct mercury toxicity. I would certainly agree that that is not the case. I would be embarrassed to put that hypothesis forward. Our concern is a much more complicated one, having to do with a much more chronic condition resulting as after low-dose exposures. Having said that, if you look at the actual sheet that's printed about thimerosal, there are side effects listed that are consistent with what some of these children have. They list anorexia, for example, as a known effect of thimerosal. They list nausea and vomiting. They list fetal loss. And so I think that one thing that has been lost in this arena is the idea that we expect all drugs to have side effects, and we would expect that in vaccines there are going to be some children that have problems with them, hence the reason for this court.
But certainly not cited for the proposition that autism, as you said, is the functional equivalent of acute mercury toxicity.
No, that is not my thesis at all.
Now, another article that you had in your report that was discussed yesterday, the first author is Stajich, and I never know if I'm pronouncing that right.
I can't do it either.
Okay, so we'll trade pronunciation skills and math skills. But Scott, if you could put just the cover.
Actually, I don't believe we've discussed that article.
Put it this way, the article was cited in your report.
Right.
And you were asked questions about why it made sense to rely on articles in your report.
Right.
And why did you rely on the Stajich article in your report?
Because it showed an outlier. They looked at a small number of children, I believe it was about 20. And in that, one of the children had a level of 23.6 micrograms per liter, I think. And my point in including it in my report was that even in those 20 kids, one of them was high enough to meet the criteria for acute mercury toxicity. That does not mean that I think that the child had acute mercury toxicity. It was just to say that there's a wide variation in how individual children respond. So if in that group of 20 we see one child who's that high, what would happen if we looked at bigger populations and considered the possibility that there will be some children that are outliers and for whatever reason develop higher blood levels and therefore potentially higher brain levels? I also want to make it clear that I'm not concerned about what's in the blood. I'm concerned about what ultimately goes to the brain and other target tissues.
Now, you were asked questions about the Berman article. Do you recall those questions?
Well, I think the way, if I'm remembering right, that that happened was that they asked me about an article that was reported to have refuted the Hornig article.
That's
Is that
correct.
The one that's I'm
that's
remembering?
Correct.
So I had not read that article, but I did read it early this morning.
And having reviewed that article and then thinking back to the questions where that article was being cited to refute Maddie Hornig's article that you had cited in your report,
right?
What do you think is significant in your review relevant to that line of questioning that you heard yesterday?
Well, I actually found it very interesting to read the article because that particular article was looking at acute toxicity. And in fact, they were not doing any kind of measures of neuroinflammatory markers. They didn't speciate the mercury. They were looking at mice, which is a good model, and it's what Maddie used, but they were not using probably the best model, which would be primates. And so they also didn't say anything about inorganic mercury in the brain. What they did look at was, you know, behaviors of the animals. And so whereas I acknowledged that it didn't find the same thing that Dr. Hornig did, we don't expect that in science. And it really doesn't impact in any way on making my opinions any less strong.
Now, you mentioned the issue of mice or rodents generally is not a good surrogate for human exposure. You were also asked questions specifically about Dr. Burbacher and Clarkson's 2005 infant monkey study. Do you remember that line of questions?
I do.
Okay. And Scott, if we could put the cover page of that article up, I'd appreciate it. And if you just zoom in on the title, just I want to make it for the record so everybody knows what we're talking about here. This is the oft-cited Petitioner's Exhibit 26, and we're looking at the cover page. Do you see that on the screen there,
yes.
Dr. Mumper? Your recollection of your cross-examination yesterday, this is the article that would have been referred to when they were talking about the infant monkey study, correct?
Yes.
Okay. We can pull that down now, Scott. I just wanted to make sure that we're all talking about the same document. Now, that study, Dr. Mumper, involved primates, correct?
Right.
What's the significance of primates in that study?
Well, primates are an excellent model to look at what might happen to humans and can be used experimentally. And primates are much, obviously, closely related to us than mice and rodents. I had the opportunity to hear Dr. Burbacher present this, perhaps for the first time it was presented publicly, I'm not sure, but it was at NIEHS in August of 2005. And we discussed at that symposium how it was very interesting the way that this was presented in the press, because it was actually spun in the lay press as good news because ethyl mercury was shown to clear the blood very quickly. And what all of us who are clinicians and scientists took away from the paper was a much more dire kind of take-home message, which was that it cleared from the blood, but ethyl mercury went to the brain and ultimately led to inorganic mercury that was in the glial cells.
Well, and actually was, now the 2005 paper, did it say that the inorganic mercury actually ended up in the glial cells, or just that it was inorganic mercury that entered the brain?
Perhaps it entered the brain. I'm sorry.
Now, the Burbacher paper that was subject to questioning yesterday, you remember a bunch of questions about blood levels?
Yes.
And there was a line of questions that involved the relative blood clearance levels in this 2005 paper between methyl and ethyl, correct?
Right.
Is this distinction between blood clearance rates between ethyl and methyl, is that why you thought this paper was important and included it in your report?
No.
Why did you include it in your report?
Because of the issue of the inorganic mercury being in the brain and the fact that with ethyl mercury, there was a significantly higher fraction from ethyl that got converted to inorganic mercury. And the other thing that I remember getting chills up and down my spine about was listening to Tom present how when they looked at the half-life of the inorganic mercury, that they were projecting that it would be in terms of decades. And that because of the way the mercury went into the brain and was converted to inorganic, they thought that there was clear evidence for a possibility of accumulation of inorganic mercury over time as repetitive thimerosal-containing vaccines were administered. They also made a point in their paper, which I thought highly of because it agreed with my opinion, that they found it very hard to understand how the Institute of Medicine could have concluded in 2004 that no further science should be done on thimerosal, since it was clear that we did not have good models for projecting about the pharmacokinetics of thimerosal. And so one of the points in the paper that was discussed yesterday was that there are limitations to applying methylmercury kinetics to thimerosal kinetics. But the concerning thing about that, when I heard him present this, is that it made me even more worried about ethyl mercury because of the very long half-life of the inorganic mercury and the relatively higher fraction of ethyl mercury that was converted to inorganic versus methyl mercury, if that makes sense.
Now, is it also fair to say that the significance of the 2005 Burbacher-Clarkson study is related to other work that involves mercury speciation and neuroinflammation, which is obviously a key part of your opinion in these cases?
Yeah, and I'm actually distressed to find out over the years how long ago this information was known, because there's been a lot published about mercury in the last several decades, and I think it was the mid-90s that Clarkson did his work on methylmercury. That was in adult monkeys, I believe.
And now we're talking, are you talking Dr. Clarkson or Dr. Burbacher and Charleston and Vodder?
Oh, I'm sorry, not Clark. Yeah, you're right. Charleston, not Clarkson. I apologize.
Yeah. And I raise that because we other witnesses, we
right.
get so many monkey studies going, we've got to keep them straight, and some of the authors are shared. So you're talking about the, and if we can, if I could just use the shorthand, we're talking about the adult monkey studies in the
yes.
mid-90s.
Okay. Yes.
And you cite Dr. Charleston's work in your paper.
That's correct.
In your report.
And I realize that that paper was about methylmercury and not ethylmercury, but the reason that I thought it was important is because it demonstrates this idea of conversion to inorganic mercury, and then the fact that there was neuroinflammation in the adult monkey brains, and that we are so concerned about the neuroinflammation that we believe to be happening in these kids. Does that make sense?
Yeah, so would it be fair to say that the adult monkey studies establish that methylmercury
right.
gets inorganic mercury into the brain?
Exactly.
And that inorganic mercury in the brain goes to glial cells?
Yes.
And that having glial cells contain a lot of mercury is evidence of neuroinflammation.
Right.
And then you then transition into the 2005 Burbacher-Clarkson paper, where they talk about, just as was the case with methyl, you have ethyl that dumps inorganic mercury into the brain. Is that correct?
That is correct.
We talked about the 2005 Burbacher paper as if it was the whole study. But is it one paper, or does it represent the entire study as far as you know?
Yeah, I think that Tom has said that they have a whole series of ongoing studies on this. And when you read the paper very carefully, you'll see that in the 2005 study that I heard him present at NIEHS, they had just used half the brains. So my understanding is that there are further studies being conducted about on the other half of those brains that I hope will be informative as to whether or not that replicates perhaps the adult findings with regard to neuroinflammation. We have to wait and see. That's part of the evolving science.
Now, you also recall a line of questionings about a deposition that you gave in the Blackwell case in Maryland. Do you remember those? And I think those questions might have been today rather than yesterday.
Yes, that was today.
Okay. I'm going to direct your attention, if we can pull it up, to a page from that deposition transcript. And this is on the deposition, and it's page 158. And Scott, if you could, under the question by Ms. Elliott, could you highlight the rest of the page there, please? Now, Dr. Mumper, during that deposition, which was in January 2007, you were asked what it meant to have a... It says, what does it mean to be a neurotoxin in your mind?
And I said, it means that the substance has either direct or indirect effects on some aspect of the nervous system, either directly on cells that are neurons, astrocytes, microglia, or whatever, or indirectly with regard to enzymes that it affects, that in fact then affect the nervous tissue, or in other ways interferes with functioning of neurologic capacity.
Okay, I'm going to interrupt you there. So would it be fair to say that neurotoxin in your mind doesn't necessarily mean cell death? Is that a fair summary?
That's exactly correct.
Because what you're talking about is functional toxicity, explicitly.
Exactly.
correct?
Yes.
And when you talk about neurotoxicity in your opinion in this case, both your testimonial opinion and in your report, are you also talking about functional toxicity primarily?
I am talking functional primarily, yes.
The statement that astrocytes microglia are involved in the neurotoxic process involving thimerosal-containing vaccines, what is that informed by? What was your basis then for saying that those particular cell types were involved?
At that time, I had already had the opportunity to speak with both Tom Burbacher and Diana Vargas about their works. So I was specifically thinking of their papers related to, for Dr. Burbacher, the monkey study, and for Dr. Vargas, the neuroinflammation, neuroglial activation paper that was published at Hopkins.
And having been reviewing this information back in January of 2007, you then had that information to rely on when you considered Dr. Kinsborn's report that you reviewed about a month ago, correct?
Yes, and in addition, I would say that on a number of occasions since I first heard the Vargas paper and the Burbacher paper, I've had the opportunity to teach that in my clinician training, because we really have regarded those as very seminal papers in our concept of what we need to teach clinicians about taking care of these children.
There's a further question there, excuse me, that asks, and Scott, you will need to bump down to the next page in a moment, but the question is at the very bottom. And it says, are you offering an opinion that thimerosal is toxic to the immune system as well? So you see the question there, and let's look at the answer. What is your answer to that question?
I do believe that to be true, so I'm giving that as an opinion, yes.
And the question was about the immune system being implicated here. Would your answer include the brain's innate immune system also?
Yes, it certainly would. One of the things that we teach a lot about in our Defeat Autism Now physician trainings is the importance of modulation of the immune system, both cell-mediated immunity and antibody immunity, but also the primitive, innate, sort of first response system. So we're really not talking in the neuroinflammatory model. We're specifically not talking about evidence of an adaptive response. We're talking about evidence of this early, innate, more primitive type of immune response. And that's best probably characterized by the microglia, who act as macrophages to go in initially and try to mop up the toxins, much like peripheral macrophages would.
Okay, we can be done with that page. So, Dr. Mumper, I now want to move on and talk about some of the questions that came later during the day today, during the day today. You remember questions about how you diagnose autism? Do you remember that line of questioning?
Yes.
And do you remember questions particularly about regressive autism?
Yes.
In diagnosing autism spectrum disorders, are there domains of symptoms that you look at in making a diagnosis?
Yes, we look in areas such as communication and stereotypic behaviors, as well as social reciprocity.
And those would be the three primary domains or categories?
That's correct.
Within the communication category, what would be included in there?
There's speech and then there's language. And language has a broader implication about being able to communicate. Language doesn't necessarily have to be speech. It could be gestures, it could be sign language, it could be using a picture system. Those types of communication would also be involved.
Because as I recall, and correct me if I'm wrong, the question seemed to focus on word counts at
yes.
particular ages. You remember that line of questioning?
Yes, and I was very resistant to giving typical word counts, if you'll recall, because as I tried to make clear by talking about things like babbling and jargoning and gesturing, there are ways that children can communicate pragmatically without using words. For example, if you have a child who is able to point to an object or tug on the mother and point to the juice in the refrigerator, that child is essentially using gesture to communicate pragmatically. So I think it is very realistic to make the argument that if you have a child who progresses to a stage where they are using pragmatic language in that way to get their needs met, and then they lose that ability, that's also losing language in the sense of pragmatic language, even if it's not implying that they lose actual words. So any mother will tell you that their babies can communicate with them in ways that do not involve words. And I think it would be a significant disservice to the children whose cases will come before this court if we are led down a path that falsely uses standardized word counts as the only way of assessing whether or not children are losing their ability to communicate.
And that's just in one domain. There was, again, a lot of focus on word count in just that one domain. Following up on the questions about regressive autism, and in these cases, are there social interaction skills that you observed in these two boys that they had and then lost?
And to say that I observed it in the boys, it would be by virtue of videotape, as I have, you know, as we've established, not met the children. But I did see very age-appropriate expressions of social interaction in both of the boys early on. And the most striking thing was that they both early on exhibited a lot of looking directly at the camera and a lot of being responsive with their faces lighting up with different events going on around them. In both of them, I appreciated a qualitative change in their demeanor. Again, at the time, I kept myself blinded as to the supposed onset of the regression, but you could see the qualitative change in their faces as they looked past people instead of engaging with them, or they withdrew from social interaction, whereas previously they had sought it out. So I think there is clear evidence of impairments in those domains and a loss of previous skills.
Yeah, and you just used the word a qualitative assessment when you were describing some of those skills. Flipping back again into the communications domain?
Yes.
Would it be as fair within that domain to say that that is a qualitative assessment rather than a raw quantitative assessment based on word count?
Exactly, because I'm very interested in how the kids use the words. And sometimes if you have very rote, repetitive use of words, which we call echolalia, that is actually a very bad sign and one of the signs that's recognized for autistic behaviors. So we're not just looking at a list of words. A good example would be a child who could say cat, dog, and pony would not be exhibiting as high a level of function qualitatively as one who could, as Jordan did, point to the cat on the wallpaper border and say meow, or point to the dog and say rough. That's an example of the kinds of qualitative aspects of language and communication that I really hope that we evaluate as we go forward.
And in these cases in particular, then, would it be your testimony that in the communication realm, both of these boys acquired communication skills and then lost them at a later point in life?
That is my testimony.
Would it also be your testimony to a reasonable degree of medical certainty that they acquired behavioral skills and lost them later in life?
That is correct.
Would it be your further testimony to a reasonable degree of medical certainty that they had social reciprocity skills that they lost later in life?
It would be my testimony, yes.
Would it also be your testimony that combining all of those three discrete opinions, that they were clear cases of regressive autism?
That is my best medical opinion, yes.
Now, I want to talk also about progress over time. Now, if a child is 1 year old, it's a little bit of a hypothetical. Say a child is 1 year old and maybe is at the low end of the normal number of words, so that even if we're looking at a quantitative analysis, mm-hmm. there are three ways that child could go in the future. They could either catch up to the norm,
uh-huh.
make progress, actually there are four ways, make progress but below the norm,
right.
plateau, or lose what they have, correct?
Right, or did we talk about even doing better than the normal? That's number five.
You know, being gifted would be wonderful, so let's include that as the fifth.
Okay.
So they're beginning at that starting off point, there are five possible outcomes.
Right.
And how many of those outcomes would you describe that child's progress as symptoms of regression?
Now, I totally lost you on the last part of the question.
Yeah.
So.
Put it this way. Only one of those outcomes would represent regressive autism, correct? That's that drop-off.
Oh, yes. I'm sorry. Yes.
Okay.
I am talking about dropping off the... Actually, losing words that they had, so that is a clear dropping off,
right.
Yes.
There were questions about single-dose versus multi-dose files this afternoon. Do you remember those questions?
Yes.
And the question was posed to you as a fact that single-dose vials do not contain thimerosal. Do you recall that statement?
I do recall that implication.
Do you believe that statement to be true?
No.
Why don't you think it's true?
Because there were no requirements that that all single-dose vials be thimerosal-free. One of the advantages of having single-dose vials is that you typically are able to get by with less preservatives, but to my knowledge, there was no mandate in that regard.
In fact, the only mandate is that multi-dose vials must have a preservative, correct?
That's correct.
And single-dose vials could have a preservative and it was not prohibited, correct?
To the best of my knowledge, that is correct.
There was also a series of questions about other environmental exposures that might contribute to the emergence of autism, particularly regressive autism. Given other exposures that may be there, and let's not assume that whether they are or not, but if they're there, what do you believe, if any, about the potential contribution of thimerosal-containing vaccines in the presence of those other possible exposures in general?
In general, I'm very concerned about the concept of synergistic toxicities. This is the concept where any given substance has the potential to be more toxic if it's given in combination with other substances known to be toxic. So the classic example is when you look at the LD50, for example, the lethal dose that would kill 50% of whatever you're studying for a single toxin and then another toxin. When they get those two things together, it just doesn't double their risk of dying. It frequently increases it by many orders of magnitude. So one of my concerns, since we've polluted our planet so much, is that children who might otherwise be exposed to lead toxicity or perhaps coal-burning power plants or live on next door to an agricultural farm that uses pesticides and also gets thimerosal-containing vaccines, that child would be subject to the possibility of synergistic toxicities. That's one of the reasons that I find it so difficult for any given child to come up with a dose of ethyl mercury given by TCVs that is going to be safe for every kid, because the synergistic toxicities are going to vary depending on whether the child's living in a lead-infested ghetto in the inner city or whether it's the child of a farmer who's using organic pesticides, those types of issues.
And with those kind of exposures, there's generally key information that's not available, including how much got into
right.
the person's body, correct?
Right.
When it got in there. exactly what the chemical formulation was. You often don't know that.
Right.
You don't know what dose entered the body.
Right.
You don't know exactly where in the body the dose might have gone.
Right.
Now, with thimerosal-containing vaccines, there's better information on the exposure, isn't there?
Yes.
And where does that information come from?
From the label on the vial or on the box.
So you know what the chemical of interest is.
Right.
You know how much was there.
Right.
You know the dose.
Yeah.
You know when it was administered.
Yeah.
You know the timing of the symptoms after it was administered. Correct? Just in terms of somebody who then developed symptoms. If they got a shot in a day and the symptoms later, you can tell that there was a gap.
Yes.
And based on the peer-reviewed scientific literature that's been discussed, you know something about the specific pharmacokinetics of the compound.
That's correct.
Knowing all of that as opposed to other exposures, does that make it more likely, in your opinion, that thimerosal-containing vaccines can be part of a differential diagnosis in the etiology of regressive autism?
Yes, that makes it quite clear that it should be in my differential diagnosis.
And that is also in review of Dr. Posian and Dr. Deeth and Dr. Kinsborn's opinions, correct?
Yes. I very much rely on them to inform me about matters of toxicology, neuroinflammation. I have to be able to rely on colleagues that I trust to educate me in those areas.
And if we think of the mechanism of injury, there were some questions about exposures and exposure levels. The exposure that one gets through the administration intramuscularly of a TCV,
right?
In terms of the mechanism of injury, is that ultimately the exposure that's of interest to you and that informs your opinion?
Tell me that again, Tom.
Yeah, the initial exposure and how much is...
Oh, no. No, I'm not concerned about the initial exposure or the initial blood levels. I'm concerned about what happens potentially a great deal of time later as this process that we've discussed where ethyl mercury has entered the brain, converts to inorganic mercury, and then causes potentially to varying degrees disruption of cellular biochemistry, neurotransmitter function, interference with crucial neuronal signaling, those types of functional jobs that those cells are tasked to do.
So just to explore the details then of your opinion in these cases, what you know in these cases is that both boys were exposed to thimerosal-containing vaccines, correct?
Right.
And based on the review of the literature and reliance on other experts, you've reached a conclusion about where that thimerosal breakdown product ends up, correct?
Correct.
And it triggers a process in the developing brain, correct?
Correct.
What is that process that you believe, to a reasonable degree of scientific certainty, is involved here?
Conversion to inorganic mercury and neuroinflammation.
And the neuroinflammation that's triggered, is that consistent with the model described by Dr. Deeth, again, that you relied on in reaching your expert conclusions here?
Completely, in my opinion, yes.
Is it your reasonable belief, is it your belief to a reasonable degree of scientific certainty or probability, that Dr. Kinsborn's model of the overactivated brain resulting from neuroinflammation, do you believe that's what happened in Jordan King's case and in William Mead's case?
I do believe that that's what happened to these children. I also believe that Dr. Kinsborn's model is consistent with what I see in my patients. And I think, in particular, one of the most egregious examples of that was the little boy I presented earlier today who had seizures for 18 years before he died several weeks ago. His clinical presentation is precisely what I would expect to see in a child who had increased excitation and decreased inhibition. Throughout the time I took care of him, despite my best efforts, he was constantly in a state of anxiety. He had a lot of stimming behaviors, and as we mentioned, he had such severe seizures that we actually had to implant a vagus nerve stimulator in him to decrease the number of seizures by 100 or so per day. And so as I've gone on this journey, everything that I've learned along the way has been evaluated in terms of my clinical experience. And I embrace those mechanisms, those scientific findings that I can, in some logical way, always tie back to what I'm seeing as a clinician, because that is primarily what I am.
And if you saw evidence that you thought significant that would change your opinion in either Jordan King's case or William King's case, would you in fact change your opinion?
I would have to do that, because I think I have vowed to tell the truth and the whole truth, and I want to maintain my credibility because I'm going to be held accountable for my opinions. I may turn out to be wrong. One of the things that, believe me, I've thought about is, why am I up here when the WHO and the CDC and the AAP and all those other organizations that were listed obviously disagree with my conclusions? So I may well be wrong and would take it on the chin if that's the case. But so far, as the science accumulates, it seems like I'm more right, and time will tell.
You were also asked questions about whether you could identify one key piece of evidence or one most important piece of evidence. You were asked essentially the same question, but in several different ways. What do you think is the key evidence that you rely on in support of your opinion in each of these cases? I mean, is there one lab result, or is it something else?
No, I really can't identify one lab result. I wish it were that easy, believe me. It would make my job day to day, you know, I could get home a lot earlier, but this is a tedious process of using a combination of clinical history, many labs together. I perhaps should take a chance for those of you who are not clinicians to explain that we ARI teach that the child is the best lab. We use objective measures because we're trying to put a story together. But we have to look at labs in context. Trying to think of a simple example, but in addition to being differential diagnoses for disease states or symptoms, they're also differential diagnoses for laboratory values. So when you see an analyte that's high, you should intellectually think about what potential things could be causing that analyte to be elevated. And if the same child has another analyte over here that also has a differential diagnosis, you should think about what things could cause that analyte to be elevated, and on and on. So as we look at our labs, what we're trying to do is to look at the thing that seems likely as the differential cause of that elevation in relationship to the other analytes, so that if you just have one thing that might suggest metabolic acidosis or, in this case, mercury toxicity, you know, that's on your list of differential. But if you find other things that are consistent with that, then you move that up to the top of the list. And it's a dynamic process. It also is informed by the state of the child at the time. And I don't know how to make that really simple. I really wish I did.
And it sounds like certainly you can't do a ranking, like your top 10 things that you would be looking for. Is that correct? Just in general, if you're looking at all of the things you would consider under the differential, you don't have some neat little checklist.
Yeah, no, I have a checklist of, you know, labs that we find to be informative in certain patients, and I don't order every lab in every patient, because part of what happens in the history is to help you rule out the need for some labs based on the clinical story. But I don't have a top 10 list.
And using the respondents' words that they used on cross-examination, key evidence. Is it key evidence in both cases here that these boys, in your opinion, suffered a clear autistic regression?
Yes.
Is that key evidence?
Yes.
Is it key evidence in these cases that both of these four boys received the full on-schedule TCV exposure?
Yes, with the caveat that I think that there may be some children who, by virtue of their state at the time of shots, would not necessarily have to get the full complement in order to have a problem.
Understood, but I really want to focus on these two particular cases and not in the more global. So the question again would be, is it significant evidence to you that both Jordan and William received the full complement of TCVs on the pediatric schedule?
Yeah, that is.
Is it significant evidence to you that you have ruled out through the medical records and the videos and talking to the parents any family history of autism?
Yes.
Is it significant to you that neither one of the siblings of Jordan or William exhibits any developmental problems, delays, or symptoms?
Yes.
Is it key evidence to you that these boys have been found to have no genetic aberrations that are typically associated with autistic,
yes,
autistic symptoms?
Yes.
Is it also key evidence that there's no sign that either of these boys received exposures to other known causes of autism, such as terbutaline, valproic acid, and other agents?
Yes.
So all of that is key evidence to you.
Right. And a lot of what you've just described is what I mean when I say evaluating the kids individually and taking the history.
And a history being an entire history that we've just,
yes,
described.
Yes.
I have no further questions.
Thank you.
Doctor, you were asked some questions about why you do the research that you do, and I believe why you employ a research director. And you mentioned that you did so because you believe it is the right thing to do. Is that,
yes,
correct?
Yes, that is correct.
Okay. And remind me again, what is the name of your clinic?
The Remlin Center.
Okay, and did you at one time have a clinic called Advocates for Children?
Yes, I actually still have that. The Remlin Center now has three different arms to it. Advocates for Children is my typical pediatric practice where I see earaches and sore throats and well babies. Advocates for Families is the part of my practice where I see the children with autism or a few kids that have ADHD or other behavioral problems that are more of a consulting basis, and those tend to be the patients that have traveled from far away. And then the Remlin Center is kind of over those two, and that is the center that was established to be a mentoring center. So one of the things that we recognized at ARI was that we wanted to provide some on-site training for physicians. And since I had the background in medical education for 11 years previously, designing curricula at the residency and teaching other doctors, and because I really love to do that, I decided to start the Remlin Center so that we could invite clinicians. And I announced my intention to do it last spring. I bought a building in June. I renovated it from July 27th to September 17th, and we opened on September 17th. Since then, we've had a doctor from Italy bring 4 to 6 patients over several times and spend several weeks mentoring with me. We've had a clinician from Australia come, and we've had several people from around the country, and I'm excited about the fact that I'm getting requests by classically trained developmental pediatricians to come and see what we do, you know, perhaps out of curiosity, but the tendency or the feedback that we've gotten so far is that when you first look at what we're doing, it might...
Doctor, I'm sorry to interrupt.
Oh,
my question,
sorry,
really was just, do you have a clinic called Advocates for Children?
Yes, I do.
Okay. Do you feel that you're an advocate for autistic children?
Yes.
Do you, because you administered thimerosal-containing vaccines for a number of years as a pediatrician, do you feel complicit in an epidemic of autism?
Yes, I do.
And do you feel that you have a debt to repay?
Yes, I do.
Doctor, you talked a little bit about your role as deciding what literature to teach, and that you do a thorough review of the literature in order to determine what literature to teach to the people in your clinic. Is that correct?
As thorough as I can, given the limitations I explained.
Okay. And you had not seen the Jill James Seapox article that I referenced on my cross-examination. Is that correct?
Yes. Remind me when that came out.
I believe it was within the last year.
I was thinking it was even newer than that, but no, I had not seen that.
Okay. And you had not seen the Berman article that tried to replicate the Hornig study, correct?
That's correct.
Okay. And on the topic of the Berman article, the purpose of that study was not to look for neuroinflammation. Is that correct?
That's absolutely correct.
Okay. The purpose of that article was to try to replicate the Hornig study, correct?
That's correct.
And the Berman study was not able to replicate the Hornig study. Is that your understanding of the article?
That is correct.
Okay. You were shown some testimony from the Blackwell case in which you testified that you were offering the opinion that thimerosal is toxic to the immune system, and then you, it wasn't in your testimony, but you qualified here today that that would include the immune system and the brain. Do you remember that testimony?
That's correct.
You are not an immunologist, correct?
That's correct.
And you are not a neuroimmunologist, correct?
That's even more correct,
And you're not a neurologist.
That also is true.
And you're not a neuropathologist.
That also is true.
You were asked some questions about the issue of whether single-dose vials did or did not contain thimerosal. Do you remember that testimony?
Yes.
Are you aware that certain manufacturers included thimerosal in single-dose vials and certain manufacturers may not have?
I delegate that task in my office actually to my nurses. They're instructed to order thimerosal-free vaccines. So I'm actually a very poor source of information about which manufacturers have thimerosal in versus out versus trace amounts.
So that was just that's an issue that you just didn't look into for the purposes of forming your opinions in this case. Is that accurate?
I will say that when I saw the shot records, I did in my mind make perhaps an unwarranted assumption that it had come from multi-dose vials.
And in any event, the amount of thimerosal really isn't particularly important to you. Is that correct? You believe that a single thimerosal-containing vaccine could contribute to autism. Is that correct?
I stated that as a hypothetical to illustrate the issue of inter-individual variability, but I would not characterize it as saying that the amount is not important to me. For me, the less, the better.
But even with less, you would still, in certain cases, be willing to render the opinion that a single thimerosal-containing vaccine contributed to a child's autism.
I don't know that I can support the idea that that the ones who supposedly only have trace amounts, I just don't know that science. I just don't know scientifically where we can draw that line. I partially base that opinion on children who came to my clinic who had not received thimerosal in their initial series of vaccines, got flu vaccine, and then the parents reported an autistic regression that was temporally seemingly related to that. But that is way far from being well studied.
You were asked some questions about synergistic toxicities. Do you remember those questions?
Yes.
Okay. And in your report, I believe that the article that you cite is the Schubert article, and this is Petitioner's Master List number 520. Does that article look familiar?
Yes.
And am I correct that this article looked at the combined effects of certain metals and actually determined that in some cases there was a protective effect when certain metals were combined. Is that correct?
Absolutely.
Okay. And this paper did not look at the issue of neuroinflammation as the result of the combined toxic effects of these substances, correct?
That's correct. Another paper that I did not list was published by Boyd Haley that did look specifically at thimerosal and its combinations with testosterone, neomycin, and aluminum. And perhaps I should have cited that as being more informative in hindsight.
But you did not cite it.
But correct? I did not, right.
And then you were asked a number of questions about neuroinflammation and the adult monkey studies that Charleston did. And you were asked a series of questions about how those informed your opinion.
Right.
Now, again, your belief that neuroinflammation is caused by inorganic mercury, that essentially came to you through Dr. Kinsborn's report. Is that correct?
The first part of that was that the adult monkey study showed that. So I didn't see Dr. Kinsborn's report until, I don't know, maybe 2 months ago or 1 month ago. And the time that I had the opportunity to talk to Dr. Burbacher was August 2005, I think. So no, it did not come to me after reading Dr. Kinsborn's report.
However, the precise model that Dr. Kinsborn is describing came to you through his report. That was the first time you had seen that model. Is that correct?
That's probably correct. We've talked a lot at ARI about the issues that he raises with regards to glutamate toxicity, increased excitation and inhibition, and the result of reactive oxygen species as detailed by both him and Dr. Deeth. But the way that he put it together for his report, and so in the sense that you're calling it a model, I agree with that model because it's consistent with what I believe to be true in my study of those same issues.
Well, we can call it a hypothesis, and so that was the first time that you had seen that hypothesis?
As articulated by Dr. Kinsborn, yes.
Right, and you were shown some testimony from the Blackwell case in which you were describing some effects that mercury might have in the brain, and you mentioned neurons and microglia and astrocytes. You didn't describe the hypothesis that Dr. Kinsborn has put forth when you testified in Blackwell. Is that correct?
That is correct.
Do you know what happened in the Blackwell case? Do you know if that case has been resolved?
I know that what happened was is that the expert witnesses participated in something that I think was called a Frye hearing or maybe a Daubert hearing, and that after that the judge ruled that that the case would not go forward, that he would not accept the expert testimony as we had put forth.
We being the plaintiffs?
Yes.
Thank you. That's all I have.
We have nothing further. Rather than doing redirect, I don't think I have anything else for Dr. Mumper.
Thank you. Any questions? I think this is it, and thank you very much, Dr. Mumper.
Thank you.
It appears that Mr. Powers, your petitioner's case in chief, you're ready to rest.
Yes, but
with your witness testimony.
That's correct, Special Master. We're prepared to rest our case in chief with our witness testimony. Understanding, obviously, there's plenty of work to still do on the case moving forward, potentially as far as July, if not later. But we do rest our case in chief at this point.
I just want to have a clarification about the moving forward to July is to take testimony of Dr. Clarkson, Dr. Adams.
Well, and a potential third test case. And rebuttal.
Fact-specific, your case in chief and fact-specific test case.
And rebuttal.
I just want because to clarify that you weren't talking about continuing your case in chief in July.
No, we are not continuing. We are not continuing our case in chief on general causation into July. When I say so, I'll just be very clear in terms of moving forward. We mean that we have a third test case that will be identified, assigned to Special Master Vowell. We'll present case-specific evidence in that third test case. We anticipate that rebuttal, since the respondent's case is going to be open at least until July on general causation with Drs. Magos and Clarkson, that we will then have some rebuttal to do after that.
That week.
I sure hope it's that week, but I just meant, Special Master, in time. I'm just saying the sequence would be after Drs. Magos and Clarkson, which would be the conclusion of response.
Let me make sure I understand what you're proposing. You're proposing that third week, that week in July, to have rebuttal evidence for Drs. Magos and Clarkson, or rebuttal evidence in general.
Precisely. We are proposing rebuttal evidence on general causation after the conclusion of their case. If there's any case specific for King and Jordan King and William Mead, would obviously have to put that on before we are done next week.
That's not my understanding of how this is going to transpire. My understanding was the last 2 days of the third week with the rebuttal to the case in chief. The record was open concerning the testimony of two toxicologists, Dr. Clarkson and Magos. We understood that if rebuttal testimony was going to come in as to those two witnesses, it would come in thereafter.
Yeah,
I understand it as well.
The big concern there is with those two witnesses, given the subject of their expert report, we might then have to bring all of our general causation witnesses back. So if we have general causation witnesses coming back, say, late in the third week of this proceeding, and then have to bring them back again, that in terms of efficiency and cost, I don't know if that's the best approach.
Testify as to what? If they're not a toxicologist, they would be unqualified to testify as to the matters that Dr. Clarkson and Dr. Magos would be testifying to. If Dr. Clarkson and Dr. Magos testify outside their area of expertise, it obviously is subject to being objected to by opposing counsel. So if they're testifying within their areas of expertise, then the rebuttal should be limited to that area.
It is difficult to understand, Mr. Powers, how you couldn't introduce rebuttal testimony to what we hear in these 3 weeks at the conclusion of these 3 weeks for these witnesses.
Yeah, and I think the issue is that the idea that we would have to have, I think, two people come back, because what Dr. Clarkson and Dr. Magos actually talks about isn't purely the toxicology. I think Dr. Apotian would be involved with both of those experts, but I think Dr. Kinsborn would be too. So again, the petitioners just don't. I mean, the Clarkson body of work and the neuroinflammation issues raised in his body of work are issues that clearly are central to Dr. Kinsborn's opinion and testimony. So having potentially Dr. Apotian and Dr. Kinsborn come back next week, then we're closed on general causation, but then we hear something in Drs. Magos and Clarkson and have to bring them both back again.
That's an if. It's probable that you'd want to put on some rebuttal. Is that what you're telling us?
Oh, you mean just even on this round? Yes,
exactly.
It is probable that we will want to put on rebuttal.
And then it is possible that you will have rebuttal after Drs. Clarkson and Magos testify.
That is true. And then the issue again is just hearing the entire case. I mean, here, in order to offer rebuttal and offer rebuttal that's coherent, the need to hear the full case.
I have to object. Not only is this new, as far as the procedure, not within the understanding, obviously, of the respondent, and I believe from what I'm hearing now of the court, but we are talking about toxicology. And I understand and I'm in agreement that if Dr. Apotian wants to come back and talk about a toxicology, that's fine, and that would be fine rebuttal. I'm understanding from some comments now that perhaps Dr. Kinsborn would come back and talk about toxicology, because my whole line of questioning, whenever I ask Dr. Kinsborn about a matter, that was toxicological, he said, outside my area of expertise, I defer to the toxicologist, which would be Dr. Ocean. I don't understand why there would be rebuttal to Drs. Magos and Clarkson from a neurologist who said, I have to defer to a toxicologist and a toxicology manager. If Drs. Clarkson and Magos step outside their area of expertise, it's subject to attack.
And just as a substantive issue, when one looks at these studies, there are issues in the monkey studies, for example, both particularly the adult monkey studies, that get into what regions of the brain certain toxicological events in which what regions of the brain, and whether that's significant or not, the types of cells that are involved. It's not pure toxicology. These papers really do deal with the intersection of pharmacokinetics and toxicology with brain function in terms of the inflammatory process and where these processes occur. And we've heard lines of questions from respondents where, directed to Dr. Kinsborn, it was apparently important enough to inquire what regions of the brain were affected.
And that was because Dr. Kinsborn seemed to be stepping outside of his area of expertise when he talks about monkey studies that had to do with the effect of mercury on the brains of monkeys. Nevertheless, and every time I ask him a question about that, that was specific to toxicology, he's a friend. This entire theory of neuroinflammation was sprung on respondent 3 weeks before trial. And at this point, for petitioners to be asking for the opportunity to come back later and work this case up further because they don't have it ready for trial, they have ample opportunity if they want to explore this theory before now. They're trying to explore this theory through this trial. We had nothing but new evidence for the first 2 days of trial. This has got to stop. This whole proceeding is just expanding and just is going to be endless at this point. They had a clear deadline of when they had to file their expert report. That came and went without hearing this theory. This theory was came up after respondents' reports came in. I think an assumption that can be made, or an implication or inference that can come from that, is that petitioners put on one theory, they saw response to it, they understood the problems with that theory, and they were met. And then they went out, as you heard from Dr. Kinsborn, and asked him for a theory. After they had seen respondent's case, they tried to come up with a new theory because they knew that the theory they were presenting on was not sufficient to carry the burden. And then 3 weeks before a trial we prepared for 6 years, this is 6 years in common, the petitioners come up with this theory. I think this theory has no merit, and I think you'll see that. I would submit you already have seen it. However, there has to be an end to this record. There has to be an end to this proceeding. And know that this can come up in another case. You might see it again. I think it'll be ended right now, this theory of neuroinflammation. I think there's nothing to it. I believe that at the end of this trial, you'll believe that too. However, the notion that because we have two toxicologists in July, that this is going to be an extension of time for the case in chief of the petitioners has to be resisted. There's nothing that Dr. Clarkson and Magos are talking about that Dr. Kinsborn can address within his area of expertise, and vice versa. To the extent Dr. Clarkson and Dr. Magos venture out of their area of expertise, you're not going to be giving it anything, obviously. I submit that when Dr. Kinsborn stepped outside his area of expertise to talk about toxicology,
let me ask a particular question. That have you, counsel, talked any further about the exact schedule for that week in July, exactly when Dr. Magos and Dr. Clarkson are going to testify? We talked about generally the Thursday and Friday, but
yes,
no, nothing further. So what exactly, I want you to get as specific as possible. What are you specifically asking us to do or rule, Mr. Madanowski?
I'm asking you to stay on the same procedural schedule that we had. We which is that in that time frame, Drs. Parson and Maddox will come in, rebuttal to that toxicological evidence and come in thereafter.
So you're asking us to limit any rebuttal that come in after Magos and Clarkson to Magos and Clark only rebuttal of their testimony.
That's correct.
You're asking that the petitioners, if they have any rebuttal to the rest of the government's case, that they bring that in at the end of the third week of this trial.
That's correct.
You want to respond?
Yes, the same position that we had taken before, which is that to do all the rebuttal at once and to do all the rebuttal at the end of Magos and Clarkson.
So are you saying you're going to forswear any rebuttal week after next? You don't want to do any then, you want to save it all to after Magos and Clarkson?
Until they're done.
Yeah. Again, we're not talking case in chief. As I said from the outset, case in chief, we're done. I've already said that we're done. I'm not proposing extending our case in chief except for the one individual test case. So it's not new evidence that we're proposing at any point in support of our case in chief. It's rebuttal. And rebuttal just making sense to have it come in after their entire case, just as Drs. Clarkson and Magos will be coming in now after the conclusion of our case. So that we don't have to have the position where there's a bringing people back for a split rebuttal.
Your Honor, again, this is a change in the procedure, and it actually may have affected, because this late change, whether we would even call those witnesses or not. We want to be at an end of this procedure.
That's a good point. I mean, almost a year ago, we agreed on these 3 weeks, and both sides knew it. And we were certainly hoping everything would be done in 3 weeks, during these 3 weeks. It was the government that needed to extend beyond these 3 weeks. I know it wasn't your fault. And I don't recall that we ever specifically talked about this specific issue. I'm sure we're not going to rule on it this minute. I'm sure we'll be talking before we rule on what you're presenting to us now. But
Nothing further. You would ask what our position was. I'm hoping I
stated. In fact, sir, one other thing that I should caveat as you rule on this, consider this, maybe this is a matter we'll take up next week. Whether respondents' position about whether the late filing 3 weeks before trial of an entirely new theory of the case may have been different had this been presented, this proposal by petitioner's steering committee had been presented at the time. We may not have ever agreed to have this proceeding go on with this new theory thrust upon us 3 weeks before trial when we've been preparing an entirely different case.
I think what we'll do is take this matter under advisement to revisit it. We obviously need to confer. And we will take this matter under advisement, and we'll return and have conversations with counsel again next week. We can anticipate commencing on Monday with respondent's case at 9 a.m. And I understand respondent will keep us apprised if there is a schedule shift during one of the days next week, so that for those who are listening at home, they can adjust their schedules accordingly, and that's possibly midweek for Dr. Rust. Am I correct with
that's
that?
Correct.
Thank you.
And aside from a potential shift, not the date, but the timing, I understand, on Dr. Rust's testimony on Wednesday, at this point, it's petitioner's understanding that there are no other plan changes in the order of witnesses and the appearance schedule that has been shared with us already.
That's correct.
Exactly. So that does leave that, depending on what you all decide, there are still the two, the Thursday and Friday, if they are still available, you know, with spillover. But whatever is available those days, if you direct us to, would be available for rebuttal.
Thank you. And before we conclude, I do want to thank William Mead's mom for being here with us today. The last parent in one of the two cases. We appreciate, again, as I expressed to William Mead's dad earlier, we appreciate very much your willingness to go public with this case for the sake of that omnibus autism proceeding. Dr. Mumper, your excuse. Thank you for being very patient there.
Sometimes we forget the
office. That's right. I think that with that, we've concluded with a robust piece of business that we'll address next week, and we are adjourned.